Now, let's see.
You just returned to the United States.
Yes, I had returned to the United States, and I had found the work at the Workers' Health Bureau very congenial and very stimulating, and I felt I had so much to learn about the labor movement that I was doing that they were doing me, in fact, a favor rather than I working with them. But Grace was always believed in a fair salary for her, for the people who worked for her, and so I started out again as we returned, working for the Workers' Health Bureau. Now, as organization secretary of the Workers' Health Bureau, it was my task to propagandize among the local unions and win their support for the Workers' Health Bureau program. This program has been fully described by Grace McDonald, but I don't know whether you want me to describe it again, do you?
Yeah, I think we'll devote a whole tape to the Workers' Health Bureau, and you should probably go on with your life, except where it intersects.
Yeah.
Or if you have another way of doing it, why don't you continue here? This is fine.
Well, see, I will therefore dwell only on some of my own experiences. I didn't say anything about the Workers' Health Bureau itself.
Okay. No, that will
because
do
separately. All right. From 1924 to 28, I traveled the length and breadth of the country to speak at local union meetings and meetings of the state federations of labor. There I would report on the results of our work, on our researches, and the impact of these on the efforts of labor to obtain better working conditions. Our program was new to most of the trade unionists. Most realized that such a program was vital to the advancement of labor. Others thought it was not a priority and could be postponed. Surely our views were far in advance of the views of the skilled worker, who had been taught to believe that a union existed for one purpose only, to increase wages and shorten hours. Health and safety were important only to those who had seen the visible effects of poisons, dusts, accidents, and other hazards encountered at the point of production, in the workshop, and on the job. I obtained support, however, among many trades, especially the machinists at the Newport Navy Yard, the building trades workers in many cities, and among the miners, whose death toll from mine explosions and dust diseases were mounting in numbers year by year. Now, see, I go on here with the Workers' Health Bureau.
That's fine. Yeah. No, that's fine.
I continue to use my maiden name of Charlotte Totus. And, in preparation for a national conference in 1927, I prepared the basis for a safety code for building trades workers, which was later discussed with our affiliates and some specialists in related fields, and with Grace's cooperation became our official WHB safety code, a document which remains a classic in the field and is even at this time, at this late date of day of automation, referred to. In fact, I think the New York State Department of Labor adopted the safety, safety code. Now, in the fall of 1927, when my husband was appointed assistant professor at University of Washington, I had to submit my resignation to the WHB. My experience, however, had been so valuable that Grace insisted that I remain another year and concentrate my activity on the West Coast, working out of my Seattle home. I arrived in Seattle at a time when labor organization was at its lowest point, with only the small core of loyal trade unionists left. The aftermath of the Seattle General Strike had been disastrous for union-conscious trade unionists. The IWW had been destroyed by government repression. The AFL was small and practically dormant. The lumber industry was the dominant force in the state and had fought unionism to a standstill. During the first year of my stay in Seattle, I devoted myself entirely to organizing work for the WHB, addressing trade union meetings in various parts of Washington, Oregon, and California. A number of unions affiliated with the Workers' Health Bureau as a result of my efforts, but it was more difficult than before because of the conscious efforts of the labor hierarchy to keep us out of the labor movement. We were considered outsiders by the AFL officialdom. The more influential our work became, the more we were a threat to the officials, who preferred to ignore the dangers to workers on the job that we were exposing. Should be to ignore the dangers that we were exposing to workers on the job. When I received word from Grace that the Bureau had decided to close, I returned to New York to report on my efforts and to learn about the steps to be taken to liquidate the experiment, which obviously was far in advance of its time, an idea that had not yet come of age.
you didn't have qualms about leaving New York, both of you?
No. As a matter of fact, I don't go into that aspect of my life. But because Bernard was a Jew, although he had gotten his PhD in 1 year, which was considered absolutely miraculous, they told him that it was impossible, and yet he did it. In spite of that fact, the people that he graduated with, like Margaret Mead and Teda Bell and all these people, got jobs, and he couldn't get a job because he was a Jew. It was absolutely impossible. He was not yet even associated very much with the left, and yet it was impossible. I can only give you one example. After his death, Mira went through some of his letters, and she was reading them until 2 o'clock in the at night. And most of them were applications for jobs to universities in the 20s, and he couldn't get a job.
Was it the Depression? Was it was just plain anti-Semitism?
Oh, it was plain anti-Semitism. There's no doubt about that. For instance, there was a very interesting letter from Dartmouth in which the president of the university said that he didn't think that Jewish people should be in sociology or anthropology or any of the social sciences. If he were in mathematics, they'd have a job for him right away, he said, or if he were in the sciences. And I remember that at 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard a deep cry, and I jumped out of bed, and Mira was sitting here and crying over the letters that he had received, in which they kept on saying, your credentials are remarkable, you have everything that we need, right now we're not taking on people, or the position that we had is filled. Or there were every excuse except that one from Dartmouth. And there was a left-winger who was a Dartmouth graduate, and Bernard showed him that letter. And he had a terrific, he was rich, and he used to give a lot of money to Dartmouth. So he had a terrific battle with the president after he read this letter. He said, you dare to say that you don't want to employ a Jew in the social sciences? How dare you do that? And this man was not a Jew. And they had I saw the exchange of letters. It was fascinating. And the Dartmouth president was decent enough to say that this is the policy of the trustees of the university.
So for after he graduated, he really tried for how long?
He taught at City College from 1926 to 27, mm-hmm. and he was dropped because the president of City College said, you are biased. And he said, why would you, and he laughed about that and said, but we're all biased. Mm-hmm. And so the president said, yes, but your bias is not our bias. And therefore, we're not going to continue you in office. You see, he was there as an instructor, and he didn't have tenure, and so they just dropped him because he had invited some left-wingers to speak to the students, and that immediately placed him on a sort of blacklist.
So you were happy to go to Seattle?
So we were very happy to go to Seattle because this seemed like a wonderful opening.
And you didn't think of staying here and doing your work and having him go to Seattle?
Well, I was with the Bureau, you see, and when I talked with Grace about it, and I told Grace that Bernard was a frail person, and I didn't think that he should work in Seattle and I should remain in New York, because I didn't think it was fair to him. I thought he needed special attention and care, and that I could relieve him of a lot of things, and so, a lot of responsibilities. So Grace agreed with me, and so I said I would go to Seattle, and then she offered me this year with the Workers' Health Bureau, which was a great help to both of us. And then after that, I found myself another work in the labor movement. You see, I didn't give up my career in the labor movement.
Right.
I simply, and it so happened that in relation to this, the Workers' Health Bureau closed, you see, because
right.
we were already under attack. And I knew when we went to Seattle that our future was very, very dim, you know, that we couldn't seem to get the support of the top hierarchy, and without them, the trade union movement was so paralyzed
mm-hmm.
by bureaucratic controls that we could perhaps remain with a small group of advanced thinkers, but we couldn't really hope to grow or anything of that sort.
So now you should probably continue here.
Yes,
you're in Seattle.
Yes, I'm in Seattle. Now, back in Seattle, I spent the last 2 years in political work and in research and writing. My close affiliations to the communists led me to accept the post of Secretary of the local International Labor Defense. Our priority then was the release of 10 prisoners from Walla Walla Jail who had been convicted in a feverish period following the attack by the American Legion on IWW headquarters in Centralia, Washington. The men had been in jail since 1919 and were virtually forgotten, except for a few loyal workers in the IWW. After some effort, I located their attorney, who had been disbarred for his part in the affair, was now a farmer. Together, we formed a committee of AFL and IWW members to obtain the release of the men. The campaign was intensive and exhausting, but we were able to rally a large section of public opinion in Washington in behalf of the release of these prisoners. The release came after I left Seattle in 1932, but the committee continued its work in their behalf until their release was accomplished. Now, during this time also, because I traveled so much in the state, I was able to form friendships among workers in the lumber industry and learned of the abominable conditions under which they were employed. To prevent unionism, the employers had set up company towns with strict surveillance over the lives of the workers and their families. In the lumber camps, under the same watchful eyes, unionism was virtually impossible. My book, entitled Labor and Lumber, was published in 1932 based on my contacts with men in the industry and my researches into the economics of the industry. That's all I say about it.
Now, in Seattle, what was your life like? Bernard was teaching and you were working full-time, night and day?
In Seattle, we had a modest apartment, and our lives were very full, meeting faculty people, trying to find people who were in some way in sympathy with our views. By this time, Bernard, who had been a left liberal, I would say, had started the study of Marx, had become very much interested in American communist politics, but not by any means an affiliate. He had many qualms and many misgivings about the communist leaders that he met through me in New York. Of course, among them was Lovestone, who later turned out to be a government agent.
So it was really you that brought these people to
him. Yes. And
about your work in Luxembourg.
No, my work in Luxembourg was absolutely abandoned and was not undertaken until after his death. Uh-huh. I just left it because I became so much involved in communist politics. Bert Wolff, who had been a very close personal friend, and his wife, Ella, were expelled from the Communist Party for their views. And there was an important decision for me to have to make as to whether I would go with them or would remain a Communist Party member.
When did you join the party?
In 1926.
In Seattle?
No, in
New
York.
New York. Oh, how did that happen?
In Seattle I went in 1927.
Right.
Well, that happened because I was, when we came back and I was working in the Workers' Health Bureau, my friends, the Wolves, were constantly after me, and I was quite sympathetic with everything by this time. My husband, however, was interested and was a follower, so to speak, but did not want to become a member. He had many misgivings. And when he met Bert Wolff, he didn't have the same opinion of him that I had. He felt that he was rather schematic and dogmatic and not especially a profound student. And Bernard was a profound student in many ways. He was a student in philosophy because of his rabbinical training, and he had deep insights into the economics of the country and politics of the country. And he was not yet ready to look at the Communist Party the way I looked at it.
But you were.
With me, yes. With me, it was both emotional and rational, but with him it was entirely rational. It was an entirely rational decision that he wanted to make, and so he was not. And I am afraid that I was sometimes very impatient with him, and that we had many arguments. But the arguments were helpful because they clarified so many things for both of us. And he was very patient with me, which I must say was one of his great characteristics, almost saintly characteristic, mm-hmm. you know, to be patient with someone who was as inflammable as I was mm-hmm. in those days.
You were the activist.
Yes, that's right. And he was both activist and scholar, but he was also scholar.
So were you active in the Communist Party? What kind did you do?
No, I wasn't. I really wasn't active. Because I was in the Workers' Health Bureau, it wasn't a good idea to have people know that I had any affiliation, you see. Mm-hmm. So and in those days, a great many people were just secret members. They didn't mm-hmm. do very much in the party itself. So I was not very, I was really just a secret member, so to speak.
So you didn't go to meetings?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I went to meetings. I went to meetings, and I heard what was going on, but I never undertook any responsibilities as uh-huh. a communist.
Not even selling the paper?
No.
Recruiting other members?
No.
Nothing.
And that was considered necessary.
Were they interested in the Workers' Health Bureau? Did they direct you?
No, they didn't. There was no direct connection. Off the record. But I don't want to put that.
No, but your party life didn't invade your work.
No, my party life was largely, shall I say, a way of expressing support and a way of showing that I went along with whatever they did, whatever the party did, but I was not an activist uh-huh. in the party.
And not on any committees or
no, nothing whatsoever. I was uh-huh. never, not in that period anyway.
And Bernard was not a member of the party.
No, he was not a member, not at this time. So at this time we had, as I say, many differences, and I must say that he raised many sensible questions about the way in which the party functioned, the leadership. He was not at all impressed with Wolf, although he thought he was very supercilious. And am I finished now with my own details? Is this my last page? I guess so.
I think of your own details.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're still in Seattle?
No, this is just before we left for Seattle. My husband became very involved with the Sacco-Vanzetti case. Not that he played any role in it, but he attended meetings and was very disturbed by that development.
And what about you?
And I too, of uh-huh. course. But by this time I was really quite committed, but he was not, you
uh-huh.
see. And his concern was very profound. He wrote letters in their behalf, attended meetings, and did what he thought he could do. But the Sacco-Vanzetti case, I believe, furnished the basis on which he began to think in a more revolutionary way. In other words, he didn't see any possibilities of for a revolutionary party before that. But after the Sacco-Vanzetti case, he saw the possibilities of developing a revolutionary party that would involve the working class and that would give the working class more power. He felt the working class had no power. He was very strongly in favor of organization of the unorganized. He was a partisan of workers' activities, and he also became at this time very much concerned about workers from minority groups, from ethnic groups. While he taught from 1926 to 27, while teaching at City College, he was invited often to speak before groups of Poles, Armenians, Russians, what else, Japanese. And he carried this over into Seattle, so that in Seattle, for instance, he became a foremost spokesman. He was always in the press for the labor, for people in the labor movement, for the labor demands, when there was any kind of discussion in the labor temple, he would talk about it with his students. He was invited several times to discuss labor history and labor conditions before the AF of L in the labor temple. And once he was charged in the press with having advocated revolutionary action by the workers to smash the machines, and it was not true at all. In other words, he was telling them the history of the Chartist movement and the history of the workers in England that he knew so well. And he showed how they first came to the ideas of trade unionism by individual actions of this sort, and then later they recognized that in unity there was strength.
And he never minded you going all over the country, organizing, being separated?
He never once made any objection, never. Mm-hmm. In all the years that we worked together, he encouraged me to do the things I wanted to do.
And did you do all the housework, or did he do some of the housework?
No, he didn't do any housework. He was too frail, and I wouldn't let him do it. And so with whatever money we had, we always had hired help. Uh-huh.
So it wasn't a burden for you.
So it wasn't a burden for me. And of course, we had no children in those days, so it was a limited thing. And then we had some problems in regard to cooking, because I didn't know how to cook. And so the simplest thing for me was to say, let's go out and eat. Mm-hmm. And he didn't like that, because there was a problem of his own needs, you know, as a former ulcer patient. Mm-hmm. He had to be extremely careful, and he was always fearful that food outside would hurt him. So there was that difficulty we had. But he recognized that if I was in the kitchen, I wouldn't be able to do the things I was to do. So he submitted to that, and we used to eat out a great deal.
Uh-huh.
But in Seattle, there was less opportunity to eat out because there weren't any restaurants. So there we had to
learn to cook.
Yeah, I had to learn to cook, but I was never very good at it. And so we ate very simple food. And
sometimes he didn't think of learning to cook.
No, he wasn't interested in that, and I didn't want to encourage him to do that. I thought it would take a great deal of his time, and I didn't want him to take his time. Whatever time he had, which for a frail man, he spent a great deal of time resting and sleeping, you know. He would sleep every afternoon for years and years and years. That's why he was able to live to age 62, because uh-huh. he took such very good care of himself. He had to.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't want him to do it. I discouraged him from doing it. So we had this cooking problem, which was later alleviated by the fact that my mother came to live with us, and she did all the cooking and housekeeping.
When did she come to live with us?
Well, that was when we returned from Seattle, but uh-huh. that's ahead of myself. We're ahead
right.
of ourselves now. In the meantime, while we lived in Seattle, my father apparently had saved enough money and had written to me saying that he wanted to get away from Boston. He thought maybe if he got to Seattle, he'd make a new start. Would I object to their moving to Seattle to be near me, because my mother was so unhappy without me?
Oh.
So I consented and found them a place to live. And first they lived with me, and then...
And Bernard then, didn't mind that.
He was saintly about my parents. He was uh-huh. absolutely saintly. Whether he minded or not, he never said anything uh-huh. about it. He was never very much in rapport with my mother. He felt my mother was a very stubborn woman. And he tried to teach her to read English and to write English. She knew how to read English, but she didn't know how to write English. And he spent hours trying to teach her.
Mm-hmm.
He was very sympathetic to her needs, but he was not sympathetic to her personality. He felt she was very, very rigid and very stubborn. However, it was her stubbornness and her rigidity which resulted in my being what I was,
right.
you see. And my father opened a little grocery store, and they did very well in Seattle. They managed very well, and they didn't need my help.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when the time came for us to get out, they were left stranded there. So in about a year, they moved back to Boston. They sold their little store. Yeah, I was everything. And not so much to my father. My father didn't feel that way about me, but my mother felt that way. My mother couldn't live without
me. She didn't have a community or friends of her own.
She did. She had a number of friends, but there was no one in her life but me.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one. I really was the substitute husband, the substitute friend, the substitute everything, you see. And, of course, it became very difficult for me because I had so many other interests
right.
With which she wasn't altogether sympathetic. My mother was not friendly to the idea of my becoming a communist. Mm-hmm. She was anti-Stalin. She was anti-Bolshevik because of the experiences of her family in Europe. And she was a reader of the Forbes, which where my cousin, who came to stay with us in Boston, became a very important figure on the Forbes staff. And this cousin influenced her tremendously. And so she, and of course he was very much against me too, but he was very fond of me. He had a great emotional draw to me. So he would forgive me for everything I was doing, but and she would too. She said, you have to do what you want to do, but I don't agree with you. So we didn't have any rapport there. So, but otherwise, she came back to Boston, and they settled down in Boston for a while, and finally, in 1941, we are ahead of ourselves, my mother decided she couldn't go on anymore without me, and my father was ailing, so he went into a nursing home, and she came to live with me, and the rest of, but during this period, she visited me for long periods. She would come and stay 2 or 3 months, take care of the house and take care of the cooking and do everything she could for Bernard. She was very devoted to him. She thought he was marvelous. She thought he was an extraordinary person, and but he didn't think she was. Anyway, he never showed in his behavior to her in any way that he disliked her. Uh-huh. He never indicated it in any way. He was always very respectful, kind, and thoughtful.
Now, you had to leave Seattle because he lost his job.
Yeah. Now, the Seattle situation is a very fascinating one, and I have loads of papers that I haven't yet unloaded on Seattle.
Where are you putting your papers?
Well, most of Burnett's papers have gone to the University of Oregon.
Uh-huh.
And that was simply because they were building up archives, and they asked for them. Nobody else did, so I gave it to them, you see. And they have good archives. They have real humans.
You should think of giving them to the Tenement Library. It's that labor library,
I know,
NYU, and then they'd be nearer you.
He wouldn't be happy with that because the Tenement Library was originally a Social Democratic outfit.
It was originally.
And he would, I never would do it for it because I know that he had differences with them.
Now they have communist papers too.
I know, but
and it's in New York.
At the time when I gave my papers, Leo Huberman's papers went there, and a number of other people. Uh-huh. You see, so I gave them the papers. They didn't do very well with them, and I had quite a little discussion with them. But they changed their archivist, and they've improved the whole thing. And I hope sometime soon to go to Eugene, Oregon, and see what they've done with them. But I haven't given them everything. Uh-huh. I haven't given them anything about his personal life, uh-huh. and I haven't given them anything about his work in the medical field, because there were many people who are still living and who, you know, with whom he had differences and so on. So I kept all that. So they only have a portion of his papers. They don't
and
have
your
them
papers. They have too.
No, they asked me for mine, and I said I don't keep any papers. I don't want to leave any papers.
Oh, you should leave the papers.
No.
It's very important. It's history. And
I know
you should
it
have
is,
respect for history so other people
can
learn.
I do respect history, but I just don't
so other
feel
people
that
can learn, and you could say that they wouldn't be opened until your daughter's death or something.
Yeah.
No, if you feel bad
well,
about
I
that,
didn't
no.
Have, you see, I didn't keep papers. I was always very, very irreverent about collecting, and my husband was just the opposite, and I think it was because he was so careful about collecting that I became very careless, you see. I was very irreverent about keeping. I had some fascinating letters from Mother Bloor and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and people of that sort, but I've torn them all up. They're gone. They're gone.
So your Seattle experience.
Yes, I would say that Seattle. The experience in Seattle was one of the most exciting in my life because, first of all, it enabled Bernard to fulfill himself as a teacher. And he was an extraordinary teacher. He was absolutely adored by his students. He made many friends in the faculty, even though they didn't agree with him always. And it was a wonderful 3-year period with Marion Hathaway, too, who was a very dear friend, who was my friend Radcliffe, and who turned out to be a most advanced thinker, a progressive mind, a beautiful personality. So we spent a great deal of time together, three of us. We had a great many exciting things happen. But most of all, it was the end of the experience that was important. Prior to our leaving Seattle, Bennett had had several talks with the president, who apparently had been appointed only a few years earlier and did not want to get into a hassle with any of the faculty. And he had been approached by some of the lumber operators and some of the fundamentalist churches about Bernard. And he told
about
Bernard,
your work?
No, not about me.
You hadn't written your book?
No, I was under the name of Charlotte Totus, and they didn't associate me with him.
Oh, they didn't.
No, and we tried to keep it separate as much as we could. Later they found out, but this was already at the end when everything was more or less over. His relationship to the the president was very eager to find out what made him tick. He was a decent kind of man, you know, but he was being pursued by all these reactionary elements within the Seattle and Washington community. So he several times called Bernard and asked him what it was all about, and Bernard said he could come to his lectures if he wanted to. I mean, he could see for himself. So he did nothing. This was after the first year that they began pursuing him. They wanted to get him out. And the fundamentalists were first. And the reason for that was that he was teaching anthropology, and he was very often comparing the rights of primitive peoples to some of the religious rites, you see. And that, of course, didn't stand up very well. And some of the students would report back to their parents. So that, and many, many of the fundamentalist ministers used to attend classes. And one of the things that alienated them very much was the fact that that at Easter time they had a rite. They went up on a very high hill in Volunteer Park in Seattle and watched for the dawn at Easter. And then when the dawn came up, when the sun came up, they were all on their knees. They would get up and say, "Christus resurrexit." And we went to one of those, what we call religious rites. And then the next day he discussed it in his anthropology class and compared it to actual things that happened in primitive communities. So, of course, this alienated the clergy, and they began pressing more. In the second year, there was more pressure. By this time, he was advocating a union for university professors because the salaries were very low, and Bernard threw himself into union organizing. He believed in unionism, and he wanted to see it happen there, and quite a number of the professors responded. Marion Hathaway helped him and so on. And there began to be a slow but certain movement of both high school teachers. There was a high school teachers nucleus, a union of high school teachers, not very widespread, but there were a few. And the high school teachers were helping the college teachers to organize. So that got abroad, you see. And then his speeches at the Labor Temple were always distorted and falsified in the press. So that he was getting a bad reputation among the establishment people. By the third year that we were there, I was still continuing my work, and we were having unemployment demonstrations, and I was several times caught up in that, but they didn't know. And
you were continuing work now, no longer for the Workers' Health Bureau.
No, after the first year. In 28, I started. It folded 2 years later, but I came back for that too. But after that year, after the first year, I came back to New York and turned over all my work and everything to Harriet and Grace, and they were carrying on. But by this time, things were very bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think they went out of existence in 1930, and I came back in 28. But when I returned, I was active in the ILD, in the International Labor Defense. I was active in the Communist Party, that is to say I served on the district committee, but my work was entirely in the International Labor Defense. I was doing a lot of writing of leaflets and
what
things.
What did you do for International Labor Defense? That was a paid job?
No, what? I was just a secretary. I was that was when we were carrying on the Centralia case and the That was in the ILD.
And what kind of work did you do?
Well, that was principally to the release of the political prisoners. Because
so
we were
ran
interested
rallies.
In rallies. We ran rallies. We ran. We had all sorts of meetings of small groups. We arranged fundraising for the prisoners. We had special fundraising for them. We made visits to Walla Walla, you know, for the prisoners. We
contacting their families.
Right, and we tried to get newspaper publicity and so on.
So you were a full-time organizer.
I was a full-time organizer for the International Labor Defense without pay.
Mm-hmm.
And so
raising money for them.
Yeah, and that was really my party work.
And the party.
So the party didn't burden me with anything else because that was my work. You see, that's what I had to do. And they gave me some help. There were people from the party that worked with me and helped me to do some of the things we had to do. There were all sorts of legal things that had to be done. We had to. There were constant discussions with attorneys on how we could best push the parole business and so on. It was a lot. There were a great many things of that sort. I haven't opened that material. I have it all here. I haven't opened.
You haven't
all
looked
that.
At all that.
No.
It was the Centralia case. Did you have to do with any other cases?
I may have, but I don't remember.
You don't remember?
Yeah. I'll have to open up all that.
Because I think there were a lot of cases.
Yeah. The only thing is, I don't know whether I have the time to. But I have all the Washington University of Washington stuff here, and of course I have all of the Joint Anti-Fascist case here too that I haven't opened. I don't know quite what to do with all that.
So you...
I don't really have the time to do it, but I'll have to do it sooner or later. Yeah. Now, where are we?
We're still in Seattle.
We're still
working for the International
Labor Defense. And my work is quite separate and apart from Burns. And at the same time, I'm traveling through the country to visit the lumber camps and getting materials for my... for my labor and lumber.
And that was hard traveling, wasn't it?
Yes, well, we had an old car, and I used to go through, and I would always stop in nearby towns where there were party members, and they
you
would put
alone.
Me up and go. I alone.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, the second year of our stay there, Berta became interested in one of the Indian tribes in Northwest Washington, the Lummi Indians of Northwest Washington. And he wrote a history and an account along the lines that Boas used of the life of these people. He had an informant,
mm-hmm.
and he got a social science scholarship and was able to pay the informant for the Indian informant for all of the traditions of the tribe and everything. And I have that book here.
Mm-hmm.
It was called The Lummi Indians of Northwest Washington, mm-hmm. which was published by Columbia University Press. So he was working on his Lummi Indians, and I was working on my labor and lumber thing. And I spent, I would say, a good year and a half contacting lumber workers in the camps, going through the company towns to
and
see how they...
didn't think it odd for a woman to be contacting them or writing
well, they
a book
did it
on
first,
them.
Yeah. They did it first,
that.
But I had a lot of... there were a lot of lumberjacks who knew me. And some of them were party members, and they paved the way for me, so it made
it
a little
really
easier.
Through the party that...
Well, no, the party didn't have anything to do with this book. It was really my own book.
It was your idea.
It was my idea, and I structured it myself and all that. But
you
I
just
didn't
made
need
the
help.
Contact.
That's right.
Idea.
I needed some help from... And there were one or two wonderful old trade unionists that I worked with very closely. One was... a man by the name of Miller, who was really a marvelous person. He was a carpenter by trade, and he was a member of the AFL, and he was also very close to some of the IWW lumberjacks who were not friendly to the communists. The lumberjack, the IWW was not friendly, but there were individuals who were friendly to the ILD, you see. And so when I went through the lumber camps, I had contacts through them with people, some of the families and some of the individual lumberjacks themselves. And, of course, I spent a great deal of time in the library getting materials on the backgrounds of the lumber industry. I have, you know, it's the economics of the lumber industry as well as the...
Uh-huh.
As
and
the,
of the ruling class in the lumber
that's right,
industry.
Right, the whole the state of Washington and so on. I'll show you the book pretty soon. So that was my life there, and it was fascinating, exciting, and marvelous, and I learned a great deal, and I matured a great deal. And I developed a great knowledge of the trade union movement. After all, I had been traveling back and forth, you know, all over, meeting all these trade unionists discussing their problems and our problems.
Were you ever interested in women's problems, particularly women workers?
I was, but not at that period. Later on, I became more interested. At that period, I was really interested in trade union organization. Mm-hmm. The organization of the unorganized was really on the order of the day. And as someone has said, we're all creatures of our time. You take the issues that are most important and you develop them. And the most important issues in those days was the need for unemployment and social insurance, unemployment insurance and social insurance, and the organization of the unorganized.
And you were very disenchanted, I imagine, after the workers' help about the AFL and what they could do?
I wasn't disenchanted. I recognized it as a problem. It was a realistic thing. You know, you knew that these people were destroying the labor movement, or were trying to keep it an elite movement for skilled workers so that they could keep wages high, and that's all they did. You know, the parallelism is with the doctors and the AMA, in a way, you know.
Right. Did you have contacts with the Trade Union Unity League at this time? Were they in existence when you were in Seattle?
Which
Trade Union Unity League?
No, the Trade Union Unity League was later, and I was in contact with them later, yeah. That came later. That was William Z. Foster's organization, and that was in the 30s. But this was still in the late 20s,
and
I'm discussing.
And so there was nothing but the AFL.
There was nothing but the AFL. The Wobblies were dead. Well, they were absolutely non-functioning. They had a headquarters, and they were always worried that they'd be raided because they had been raided everywhere else. And there were only a few old hangers-on that came, and the rest of them were out of work. They were on the skid row. They were really.
Could you see the beginnings of the Depression when you were there?
Oh, yes. That was obvious. There was very little employment, and most of the lumberjacks were unemployed. I mean, there wasn't very much work. The lumber camps that were working were very few, and lumber itself was in a very sad state when I was there. So there was a great deal of hardship and a great deal of suffering, a great deal of poverty, and I had very good contacts with the men on the skid row. The men on the skid row were the unemployed. Some of them were like Bowery bums. Others were striving to find jobs. And then there were a lot of Wobblies, too. And I used to go down there and talk and have and hold, you know, we'd have outdoor meetings, and I would...
About getting organized?
About getting organized, about the unemployment situation, about the need for social insurance. I mean, all the issues of that time, I would present to them and give them what the party position was on this, you see. And we tried to recruit. I didn't personally do any recruiting for the party because I didn't want to be known as a party person in the ILD, you see. So I just attended meetings and I did things for them on the side. But there were other people who used to go to these meetings and do the recruiting, you see. There was a general feeling everywhere that if you worked with people outside the party, it was best not to say you were a party person. And so for years, I was always working with trade unionists and so on. So it never came. I was never really openly a party person.
And when you wrote your book, you just had the idea of writing it. You didn't contact a publisher first.
No. I will say this, that Grace had a great interest in the labor Labor Research Association, which followed. The Workers' Health Bureau. In other words, when the Workers' Health Bureau closed, she had this marvelous library, and she had an interest in that building, a realty interest in the building. So it was possible to get those offices rather cheaply through her. So she turned this over, and then later it became the Labor Research Association. She turned all that material over to Robert W. Dunn, who later became Secretary of the Labor Research Association. Now, at the time that I was working on the book, I was in contact with international publishers. I had written them about this, and Trachtenberg wrote me a note saying, we're getting out a labor and industry series, and we have now labor and textiles that Grace Hutchins is doing. We have someone working on labor and shoes, labor and labor and steel, labor and coal. And so he said, would you be interested? So I wrote back and said, well, it works. It so happens that I'm gathering material for a book on the lumber industry. And if you want to include it in your series as labor and lumber, I'll be glad to send you the manuscript when I finish it. Well, he was very excited about that because it was hard to get good writers at that time, just as it's hard to get them at this time, you know. So the result was that he said, send me the manuscript when it's ready. And so I did when it was ready. And it went through some changes and so on, but generally it was what I had done. And most of it came from Seattle while I was working there. In other words, I kept sending him chapters and so on.
And he didn't censor much of it, or?
No. I think that mostly the changes that were made were not made on a factual basis. They were rather made, on the way in which something was worded and so on. After all, I was not then as much of a writer as I am today, you know. And I must say that if it were not for Bernard, so Bernard was a natural writer. He would sit down and he could write anything. He thought very clearly, and he could write, he could express himself very simply and very lucidly, you know. And he was just a natural, and he perfected his writing. He worked at it, too. He worked at writing a great deal. He believed that it was like a skill that you develop as a professional performer, you know. You just had to keep your skills up. And so he spent hours expressing, rewriting, working over sentences and things. He was a very, very accomplished writer, and I think if he had lived, he probably would have done something very interesting. He was working on a history of technology when he died, and his, I always admired his writing. His writing was always very lucid and very, very good. So he helped me a great deal.
With your writing?
With my writing, yes. Uh-huh. I would turn over a chapter that I'd written, and he'd tell me what was wrong with it, and he'd say, this, you have to do this way or that way, and sometimes he was very impatient. Because he said, you ought to be able to do better than that. But you see, I really was handicapped because in my early youth, I didn't have much of an English education, you see. Everything that I learned about writing, I learned when I was already quite mature.
But didn't you have to write a lot for the Workers' Health Bureau?
Yes, but it wasn't the kind of writing. It was... Well, I don't know. And it started late, you know. Started late. I had papers
at Radcliffe, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Reports on housing.
But I never was quite confident of my English, you know. Although
you
I did well.
You have a Boston accent.
Hmm?
You practically have a Boston accent.
I do. I still
you
have
do.
It, don't I? Yes. Most people recognize it when they hear me. Yeah. I haven't maintained it particularly because I wanted to. It's just there.
No, I mean, there's no Yiddish accent in Boston.
Well, you see, I did. I worked very, very hard on my English, I must say. By the time I met my husband, I really was rather accomplished in English, you see, because I'd been making speeches and I had been I've been doing a little writing, but never anything for publication until we worked together. But I had a hard time doing that labor and lumber, and I think it was largely because I had never done a full-length book. You see, most of them were written articles. And so it was really quite a tour de force for me. But I learned a lot in doing it, and of course, Mira thought it's a very shrill book, and it probably is because I was very ardent in my beliefs, and I saw things firsthand, and I was very much stirred by them, you see. So that was how it happened.
So you finished the book.
Finished the book, and
did it get reviewed and have an impact?
Oh, yes.
And then had an impact?
Not very much.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, international publishers didn't have much promotion. Wasn't able to do much promotion.
Did you do it on your own?
A great many wrote to me, particularly from lumber areas, and asked me questions. And in general, most of the progressive media gave it a good review. I have some of those reviews somewhere. I should have. Finally, during the last year, that was 1929. University issued a questionnaire among the students, asking them to evaluate their teachers. This had never been done before, and at least it wasn't done to our knowledge, and everyone was quite shocked to think that the students would be asked to determine whether their teachers were qualified or whether they were teaching them properly and so on. And but most of those people who were close to us felt that this was a strategy, or a tactic rather, to be able to shift the responsibility for expulsion of Bernard on the student body, you see, and say, by saying that the students recognized that he was teaching matters that were inimical to their interests and their way of life and so on. So this was some theory of some of them. However, Bernard, in his usual way, welcomed this and said he would like to know what he'd like to have an evaluation of his students, and that he was ready to distribute this questionnaire. So he had large classes because he loved to teach Sociology 1. And that was the biggest class. He had about 100 students, and then he had other classes. And altogether, there must have been 150 students who answered this questionnaire of his. But this was distributed to the whole university, so it wouldn't appear that just one member of the faculty was being discriminated against. When the results were tabulated, Bernard was the fifth most popular professor on the faculty, and this after being there only, he was there 2 years, 2.5 years, was a great tribute to him. And some of the people, especially on the faculty, who rather supported a conservative or reactionary position, were quite shocked to find that the students really liked what he was teaching. And many of the students said in their evaluations, because they were given to us, that they recognized that this was a trick to devaluate a good professor who was so stimulating and so alert to their interests. Anyway, that was not a good excuse. You see, they couldn't use a man who was the fifth most popular in the whole faculty, and there were several hundred people on the faculty, so if you're fifth, it's rather high. Yeah. So that couldn't be an excuse for the president to get away from with saying that he was not a good teacher. So we waited that year, and nothing happened. And that year, Bernard had discovered the papers of Lewis Henry Morgan, who was an anthropologist that had been whose work had been praised by Engels. And
based practically
yes.
The whole Origin of the Family on
right. Morgan. And Bernard had read The Origin of the Family, and he had read Engels considerably, and he was very attracted to the idea of looking over Morgan's papers, and he discovered them at the University of Rochester. They had never been touched before. He wrote to the University of Rochester, and they offered to open the papers for him, and then we had to get some money because we were going to be away all summer. So he got a Social Science Foundation grant of, I think it was $500, or maybe it was $1,000, and we decided to go to New York, and I would work in New York for a while if I could, and he would go to Providence where the papers were at Brown University. So
they weren't at Rochester.
Did I say Rochester?
Yeah, you meant Rhode Island, right?
No, now wait a minute. They were at the University of Rochester. Yeah. Now what did he do? Oh yes, he did something else at Brown. He didn't go to Rochester. He went to Brown, and that was for the List Award papers. He had already been working. No, he worked on the I'm all mixed up. I don't remember when he worked on the Rochester papers, but he went there for one summer. I know that. Now, when did he do that?
The Lewis Henry Morgan papers were probably in Rochester. They wouldn't be in Brown.
The List Award papers were in Brown.
Right, and the Morgan papers were in Rochester.
Rochester, and I don't think he ever went to Rochester. I think the papers were sent to him through Columbia.
Uh-huh.
That's how it happened. But he also discovered the List Award papers, and he wanted to see those. So he went to Brown, and to Brown University, where they were. And I stayed in New York. And during that summer, I worked with the International Labor Defense.
Doing what?
Well, I worked on their magazine. They had a magazine, and I worked on their magazine.
What was the magazine?
It was called Labor Defender.
Oh,
and
I did
articles for them, and I edited. You know, I worked more or less in a volunteer capacity. I wasn't getting paid.
You wrote articles about what?
Under the name of Charlotte Todes?
Todes.
I may have. I don't remember. I don't think I have those. Or I may just have written articles without signing them.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. Oh. Because later, you know, I became the editor of the Labor Defender. It's not in here. But
no. Who did the Labor Defender go to?
The Labor Defender was a subscription magazine that I think they paid $1 a year or $2 a year, something of that sort, and it had a very large subscription, subscribing public, and there was great interest in it. It was a very good magazine. Prior to my taking it over, James Allen was the editor.
He's the international editor that I got along with that I was telling you about.
Oh, really? I don't always get along with him. He's very arbitrary, too. Now, I'm trying to think that summer. That summer...
This is before he's fired.
Yes. Now, before we left that summer for New York, we went to the mailbox, and there was a letter from the president to the effect that because of the economic situation... they were forced to cut back many of the faculty people. This was the excuse, you see. And that he could come back for another year, but that's all that they could give him. Well, of course, that was a terrible shock. And we debated at that moment. We were on our way to the train, practically, and we debated...
to go to Seattle.
Whether to leave Seattle or and go to New York. Or and the question was, should he give up the summer... the summer's research work, and I said, no, don't give it up. Let's go to New York and let's see whether there's something there for you. Perhaps you might be able to get another appointment.
He didn't want to fight it there?
Well, we were upset, you see. We didn't know exactly what to do, you see. And we were coming back because they gave us another year. Mm-hmm. But why give up the summer?
Right.
So we both went to New York, and the summer... Some
you worked for the Labor Defender.
And I worked on the Labor Defender, and he was...
writing articles about what kind of cases were
well,
coming
mostly, up Well, mostly civil rights cases of one sort or another, and I have no
You don't remember them.
I don't recall them at all.
They were like cases that amateurs were being put in jail.
There was I don't think the Scottsboro case had broken.
No, the Scottsboro case was later. That's
but there were...
No, I
don't remember. I really don't
remember. You don't remember what kind of cases?
I don't even remember.
I was the editor. Were fired?
Don't remember. I have no recollection. There were persecution of blacks, mostly.
It was blacks?
Oh, sure. In the South, yes.
In the 20s. And
yes. Well, you know, James Allen and his first wife were lived in the South, and underground all the time, and they had all sorts of experiences. There was a great deal, there was a lot of lynching going on. I remember that we spent a lot of time on lynchings.
Lynching, right.
Yeah. And you see, it was a picture magazine, so there was a great deal of a great many photographs.
And did it go to mainly trade union members?
It went to
liberals.
It went to a very varied group. Workers, trade unionists, liberals, intellectuals, professionals, a great many people subscribed for it.
Mm-hmm.
It was practically the only civil rights magazine at the time.
Was it connected with ACLU? Or
No. It was definitely a publication that was dominated by party leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of very good people that were in charge of it, too. What was his name? Engdahl. Engdahl was one of them, and he died. And James Cannon, who was a brilliant writer, who later became a Trotskyist and left the party, he was also one of the editors. As a matter of fact, he was the one, I think, that gave me Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's address. Originally.
And you didn't have any trouble as a woman being the editor
of
the paper?
No, as a matter of fact, they were only too anxious to have me. I could have gotten any kind of a job because of the fact that I published this book, Labor and Lumber, and they needed people. They needed writers. They needed people like me, you see. And I never had any... And that, in that regard, there was never any discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
In political jobs, there might have been, but I wasn't ambitious for those things, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I was just ambitious to serve in my own capacity in the way, and you know, with whatever gifts I had to give to the movement. But I had no ambition to rise in the movement.
What did you see your gifts then?
Well, I thought that I could, I certainly thought that I could contribute in, I never was a very good organizer, but I thought I could write pamphlets and leaflets and edit things, and I could do research for the party, whatever they wanted, and I saw myself really in that category, more or less as the journalistic aspect, rather than being an ambitious for political office of any sort. I never really wanted to have, and then I was also very much interested in trade unions, you see, and trade union organization. So all of this was my orientation, but I never thought of myself particularly as being a good party organizer. That I didn't think of. Well, now, here was a letter telling him that he was through after a year. And on the way home, on the way back to New York, we were quite upset about this situation. We didn't quite know what to do. And one weekend, when Bernard came to see me, to visit me, he said, you know, I think I will go to see Alvin Johnson. They had started the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences, and Bernard had been reading about it, and he said, you know, he may be interested in taking me on. So I said, that's a good idea. And he went to see him. And he said, you know, I'm going to visit him early in the morning because I'm sure that after 9 o'clock he won't be available. But if I get there at 8, he may be working or something. And, you know, it so happened that in the Middle West and in the West, people started work at 8 o'clock in those days. So he got up it was right here on Morningside Drive and 122nd Street. And sure enough, there was Johnson sitting by himself at a desk, and the whole place was wide open. And
you were working at in New York City with the Labor Department.
That's right. And I was living in Bob Dunn's apartment. He was not there, mm-hmm. So I was living in his apartment downtown. When Bernard came back, he said, you know, Charlotte, I think I'm going to work for the Encyclopedia. Johnson seems to like me. He was walking down to where the new school is now on 12th Street, and he bumps into Alvin Johnson, and Alvin Johnson says, say, I'm going to hire you. And it happened just that way. He was on the staff. So we started work first week in September, and we wrote back to Washington that we were not coming back.